And so the first talk after the break is by Richard Sarris from the Department of Mathematics at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The nice short title, Geometry of Defaults.
Geometry of Defaults. Thank you.
By the way, thanks for inviting me, the organizer. This is just a wonderful conference. We all talk about interdisciplinary research, but this is, I think, one of the best conferences that I've been at where it actually is interdisciplinary thinking. Okay, so this work is joint with my colleague Hal Schenck and a grad student Rui Song, and it's entitled "The Geometry of Defaults." So we all have heard various things about systemic risk, but complicated networks and how things interact. And several years ago, I started to sort of think about this and started to pursue a little bit of a circuitous path, and this is sort of the result of what we've been thinking about. And I am a mathematician, so I feel a little bit like a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, apologies, but the story that I'm going to tell I think brings some tools in that hopefully will have something to say, but it's a little bit outside of the standard collection of things that we've heard here. Okay, so we heard several comments over the past several days about networks, things like that, and things interacting with each other. The goal here is, I want to do something that you can actually use real data as an input to what we're doing. Okay. And I want to think about something which respects the reality of networks. So the reality of networks is that there are a few 800-pound gorillas in the room, and then there's a whole, the list of systemically important financial institutions is actually 40 or so, but there's only a few which have above 2 trillion, and then there's all sorts of smaller institutions also, and I'd like to think about something which does not oversimplify that too much and allows us to actually say something meaningful given the heterogeneity of the whole financial network. I want something which is honest to golly explicit, and the result is a framework, not a full theory, so I'm anticipating that at the end of the talk, my standard answer will be, good question, I don't know the answer. So the result here is something which is decentralized. We've heard a lot of talk about decentralization, and I think what we've come up with is decentralized, and it's also global squared, and we'll understand what I mean by global squared at the end. There's going to be two global things which we're going to put into our thinking. Some of the other things that have been that are sort of related to what we're doing, there's some machinery on or some attempts to use random graphs in understanding financial networks, and Andrea has done and Rama have done a lot of really interesting things using trying to understand various things on financial networks, and I will point you to her work and also to the references in her work. One of the problems though with the random graph thing is this heterogeneity. You build a random graph and then you put that in the hands of a bank examiner, and then they go to Goldman Sachs and say, look, our random graph says that you should have more capital. Then Goldman Sachs says, yeah, we're not a randomly selected bank, right? We're Goldman Sachs. So one has to be careful, and that sort of circles back to what I'd like to do, something you can use real data as an input for, okay? And which respects how the actual financial system looks, okay? So let's start out with Eisenberg No. We've heard about this several times, and it's a really cool thing. And in fact, we heard about this problem. Well, we heard about this problem yesterday, but let's sort of set up the framework of Eisenberg No. You have a whole bunch of people who have obligations to each other, or liabilities to each other. I owe something to someone, but then I have some money in my wallet as an endowment, okay? And then the music stops and everyone has to try to pay everyone else what they owe, but if they don't actually have enough money, they pay proportionally. This is one clearing system, and it's decentralized and it's network-wide, so that's why I like it. There are other clearing systems, but let's go with this. We could actually substitute another one later on if we want. But sort of here's the one of the complications, and we heard about this yesterday. If Alice owes Betty $10 and owes Christina $20, but Alice only has $6, well, she's going to pay proportionally, so she's going to pay Betty $2 and Christina $4. Okay. The complication, though, is that Alice may have $6 in her wallet, but she may be getting $5 from people who owe her. Okay. So you really have to look at how everyone interacts with everyone else. Okay. And there's some work by, I think, Peyton Young and Paul Glasserman, which attempt to actually bring the whole Eisenberg no calculation a little bit more to reality in terms of a sequence of attempts to clear a network. And if you try to do that in several steps, you'll probably ultimately converge to Eisenberg no. Okay. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to, first of all, just for the fun of it, because it is such a cool mathematical thing, let's just go through it. I asked around if everyone in this audience knows Eisenberg no, and I got the impression that, well, it might not hurt to just mention it. Okay. So the mathematics is the following, that, well, while people may owe other people, we should actually maybe define a different variable, which is the amount that you actually pay. Okay. And, well, you pay, the C's are what you pay, but then you also have a question of how much can you actually pay out. We'll call that A. The amount that you pay out is how much you actually have in your wallet and how much other people pay you. Okay. We can probably sum up our liabilities, how much I owe to the network, and rewrite it, so forth and so on, and I guess then you can start to write things down that the amount that you actually pay other people is, well, if you have enough money, then you pay. If you don't have enough money, then you pay proportionally. We write it like that, and if you write it the right way, you get that. And then maybe I didn't actually, P is the, I didn't do, oh yeah, that's P. And I guess if you look carefully, you take that and then you can rewrite it like that and then rewrite it like that, and then you can actually make it all work. There's a nice iterative procedure. You can write it as a minimization problem. It works, okay? But what I want to actually point out here is that this is global, okay? So here, the payment, whatever P is, it basically goes through the whole network, okay? It goes through the whole network of how much I'm liable to everyone else, okay? So this is one source of a global, I almost want to say contagion, but okay, it's a global effect, okay? All right, so. And the other thing that I want to actually think about here, oh yeah, that's the short form of the Eisenberg no equations, that thing that P is equal to the endowments plus a liability matrix appropriately normalized and transposed times P, and then there's a minimization thing element by element with the actual liabilities that I owe everyone. Okay, so it's a nice cool short equation. What I'm interested, though, in is the shortfall, okay? So the default occurs if I don't actually have enough money to pay other people, right? So that's when I'm in default, and I want to think about defaults. And I also want to think about how much I'm in default, okay? Do I owe someone a dollar, or do I owe someone $100, okay? So the shortfall is going to, we're going to think about that, okay? And assumedly you would think that a big shortfall is bad, right? If lots of people owe other people lots of money and they can't actually pay, that's bad, okay? So these are somehow to be thought of as weights. Okay, so let's actually, though, think about a specific example where some interesting things happen, okay? All right, so this is this is sort of what we heard, Martin mentioned yesterday, that if you have A owing B something, B owing C something, and then C owing A something, I want to take that loop, I just want to add some leakage out to another counterparty. So, well, okay, let's say that, let's label the top one A, that one B, that one C, and then the one over there D. Okay, so what's in the circle is how much they actually have in their wallet, their endowment, okay? And let's say that their liabilities are 10, 10, 10, and then the top one owes D $15, okay? And, so then let's actually crank up the Eisenberg no machinery and the defaults and the payments. So let's see. So what's in the circle here is how much they're actually paying, okay? So this one is paying $5, that one. This one has to pay out $6, all of it to that one. This one has to pay out $10, four of it to there and six of it to there, okay? And if you subtract this from that, you get this, okay? So namely, although that upper link there is, you should be paying $15, you're only able to pay six, so there's a $9 sort of loss to the whole system, okay? There's a $6, I guess I mislabeled the graph, oops, okay. There's something here, I mislabeled it. Oh, no, it's okay, yeah, 10 minus 6 is 4, 10 minus 4 is 6, 10 minus 5 is 5, right? Okay, so this is the shortfall, okay? This is the shortfall, namely how much money has sort of been promised but ain't being paid, okay? All right, so regulatory perspective. Anyone here who has at least, or who has several children will think that if your children start to argue with each other, you send them to a room and you say, sort it out, right? Okay, so maybe from a regulatory perspective, A, B, and C should be told, go sort it out, right? You all owe each other something, but, it's sort of, right? I mean, you're owing each other, and it's sort of like a circular firing squad, right? So, 6 and 5 and 4, and so maybe from a regulatory perspective, you want to let A, B, and C sort things out themselves, and maybe you want to just directly inject some money into D, okay? All right. So once again, I'm going to say this with an incredible amount of humility because I'm learning so much here, so much that I don't know, and that all of you in the audience who actually know how the banking system works will no doubt understand why this won't work or what's wrong with it or how to make it better or something. But the idea here is that somehow D is distinct. That link is distinct. And maybe I should, from a regulatory perspective, treat that obligation differently than I should those three there. Now, what I'm actually interested in here is the fact that although 6, 5, and 4 are maybe bad, they're all close, right? So if I send A, B, and C to the room, okay, then somehow there's only at most a difference of 2. Right, 6 and 5 and 4. They're all pretty close, even though they're sort of biggish. If I let them sort it out, at most there should really be only about $2 that the economy has lost. Let's say that the system has lost that ain't being paid. Okay, So that's sort of interesting. And What I want to do is I actually want to take this a little bit of a step further and think about ranking the counterparties, okay, in the network. Okay, so that's sort of... So when we think about, I mean, Eisenberg, no, is a beautiful model, but so what? Okay, what can you do with it? And, I mean, the music never really stops, right? Traders get out of their positions by the end of the day. Usually, I mean, the network rarely totally clears, right, forcibly. You don't really have many defaults. So Eisenberg, no, is, you know, it should be... If one wants to put this into reality, it should be done with care. So what I want to think about doing is using Eisenberg No, which is global, to construct something of a ranking system. Okay? A ranking system where the difference between A, B, and C is somehow, let's say, 2. Okay? And where that off to the side is different. Okay? Let's now, okay, so this work is inspired by Jan, Lim, Yao, and Yuan, who did something sort of cool, and they thought about a Netflix problem, okay? So instead of thinking about defaults, which are a directed edge, let's think about preferences. How many people here liked Gravity more than The Wolf of Wall Street? Audience participation, right? I love it. But you can think about rankings in Netflix, right? Okay, one is better than another, okay? And you can aggregate, for the Netflix problem, you can aggregate the preferences to get a directed edge, okay? Just like you can with the defaults, okay? So I want to take this technology and sort of apply this technology to Eisenberg No and see what comes out. Okay, so let's take our loop with leakage and let's write this as follows, okay? So it's $4 A defaulting to B, $5 B defaulting to C, $6 C defaulting to A, and $9 A defaulting to D, okay? Where the little brackets and the A's and the B's means that that's how much they should be paying in default. Let's fake it and say that this thing is asymmetric, okay? Or that it's so that AB is equal to minus BA. So if A is defaulting to B $1, let's sort of mythically say that that's the same as B defaulting to A negative $1, okay? One has to sort of hold one's nose economically at that, but let's do it anyways, okay? And so here the defaults are 4, 5, and 6, and 9, but you could put anything here, right? So what we really could think about is a vector space, okay? A vector space whose bases are that, 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 and that, okay? All right, so we want to think about here a four-dimensional vector space. We'll call it V2 because it's, constructed from pairs, okay? All right, so it's edges. And we're thinking about edge defaults, okay? Now, here's the interesting question. Up there, it's 6, 5, and 4, but what happens if it's dead on, if it's 5, 5, and 5 defaulting to each other, okay? And we really want them to cancel out, okay? So what would happen to A defaulting to B, $5, B defaulting to C, $5, C defaulting to A, $5, if Ben Bernanke were to call A, B, and C into the room and say, figure it out before you go home, let's say, okay? All right, so, well, let's construct a linear operator, okay? Let's construct a linear operator, and let's call it D, because that's really what it should be called, okay? It sort of takes something to the boundary, all right? And D is going to take the directed edge AB into, well, B minus A. So if A is defaulting to B, then somehow B should be, if there were to, let's say, if there were to be more capital injected into the system, this would mean that B would be getting a dollar and A would be losing a dollar with the extra money that would be put into the system, okay? And what's interesting, if you take that operation, is that if you, all right, take the, I mean, mathematically, it's the weighted edge, or the weighted edges of the, or the weighted ends of the directed edge, okay? All right? And if you take that weighted sum of the edges, or the ends of the directed edge, and you do that for the different links, it all telescopes to be zero. All right? Okay? All right. So, now, let's just, for the fun of it, let's define a new vector space, V1, which is, namely, all sums of the A's, the B's, the C's, and we could also put the D's here, okay? And geometrically, what we've just said, going back to linear algebra, undergraduate linear algebra, is that loops are in the kernel of D2, okay? So loops are in the kernel, and we like linear algebra. There's all sorts of geometry floating around with linear algebra, right? Okay. Kernels, ranges, orthogonal decompositions, and all that fun stuff, right? Okay.
Are you going to allow yourself different currencies as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I guess so. Yeah. I don't know exactly how that would change anything.
It's changing the weights and the ratios.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Hadn't thought about that. Okay. So loops are in the kernel of D2, and just for the fun of it, okay, for the fun of it, let's define a new object, which is called a triangle. Okay? And the triangle is, I don't know quite what a triangle is economically, but that's not gonna stop me. Let's define an abstract triangle, and let's define a linear operator from the triangle into the edges. Okay? Let's see. So, maybe I think I missed some negative. No, that's okay. All right, yeah. So, let's define a map from, let's define some triangles, and let's define a map from the triangles, or let's say trading loops, into the edges, okay? And, well, we can construct a vector space of triangles, and I guess what's sort of interesting here is that the image of V3, the image of the triangles is the loops, and the loops net out to zero, okay? So now we're starting to see a little bit more geometry, namely that the range of D3 is contained in the kernel of D2, which is a subset of the V2 vector space, and all this stuff here, it's, you know, playing around with linear algebra, okay, if you think about it. What the heck are these triangles? Economically, I don't know, but I really like this picture, okay? I really like this picture, which says that if I have a loop which is not Alice, Betty, and Christina, but Alice owing Betty, owing Christina, owing Donna, owing Elizabeth, owing Alice, I can put some little edges in there and triangulate that bigger loop, okay? So now we get to an interesting thing, okay? So it's, You can say, okay, there's one triangle, Alice, Betty, and Christina, who are trading with each other, and a regulator can go in and see, yeah, you three are trading with each other, we can figure things out, okay? But what happens if the loop contains 5 counterparties? Okay, what happens if there's a trading loop which is global, okay? So, you know, you have 5 counterparties, and this is not outrageous. Then let's basically take that more complicated loop and triangulate it, and the math here starts to say we have a chain complex which is a collection of vector spaces and some linear operators which take the range of one is in the kernel of another chain complex. And this is what the Netflix problem did. You can actually get a little bit more complicated. So what we just had is this, but remembering linear algebra, linear operators have adjoints. So there's a map which takes the triangles into the loops and the loops into the edges, but then there's an adjoint map which takes the edges back into the loops and another adjoint map which takes the loops back into the triangles. And the interesting thing here is that there's something called a Hodge decomposition in mathematics, which says that our loop space can be decomposed into three things, okay? The range of D3, okay, which is basically the single loops, Alice, Christina, or Alice, Betty, and Christina. The range of D2 star, which is interesting, and the kernel of something called the Laplacian, which is basically start out at V2, take the left loop, or the left collection of things, go that way, then back that way, and then go that way, and then that way. Okay, so that's called a Laplacian. And what they did is they said, this is actually cool. You can actually get something neat for ranking with this decomposition. Okay? Yeah?
In the Netflix example, what are the nodes? Movies?
Movies. Movies and preferences are the... Everyone likes Gravity better than The Wolf of Wall Street, so it's the weight of the preferences.
People, movies.
Yeah.
That's a bipartite graph.
Yeah.
Here is monopartite graph.
It's similar enough that it works, okay? Let's.
Because, I mean, in recommender systems, you always project.
Yeah. It's not really a recommender system, right? I mean, it's not really a recommender system, okay? Okay. So let's. So what they said is that if you fill in the triangles and do this stuff, then the range of V3 basically is locally inconsistent rankings where it's a Alice, Betty, and Christina. The Laplacian is the global things, okay, which you would actually need to think about if you were trying to regulate those. And then this range of D2 star is the rankings with no cycle, and these are the consistent rankings, okay? All right, these are the consistent rankings. So what the implication of this is that the best ranking is given by projecting onto the range of D2 star, and that's what I want to do. Okay, so let's get back to our financial stuff, and let's just look at a simple example, okay? All right, so let's look at this network. Now, this has no loops, but it does have the interesting fact that somehow B is defaulting to some people and 0 is defaulting to some people. And we got this from actually looking at a meaningful system. It has no loops, but okay. So sort of the question here is how does 0 compare to 4? Okay. All right, but let's just go through the setup here. So we have some defaults, and these are the nodes, these are the edges, and there's 7 edges in this graph, okay? And then there's 3 triangles in the graph, 1, 2, 3, okay? And if you actually do, so I'm just rewriting things, if you write down this matrix D2, which takes loops into edges, you can get that the size of the defaults are this, and you can project onto that, and I'm just going through all sorts of things, but at the end of the day, you get that you can, if you start from somewhere, pick a reference point, you can rank all of the nodes in the network by their defaults, who's defaulting to who, okay? And this is the ranking. Okay. All right. So, well, I mean, let's actually see what happens. Okay, so we got some data from the, I think it was, this was several years ago, and someone from the Fed helped us. And this is from the, I think, BIS. We got some, you know, this was somewhere, and we, this is how much different countries are, I think it's central banks owing to each other. And then we somehow figured out some endowments. We faked a lot of it. You know, we took wild guesses and tried to get some sort of meaningful assessment of endowments. And okay, but then we came up with this ranking. Okay, and the red ones are the ones which are doing a heck of a lot of defaulting. I'm not sure that I believe everything, but I'm not sure that I totally believe that this is the correct ranking. But it's sort of, it's interesting. It's interesting. So let's actually think about this now. So the reason why we did this, the actual example is we wanted to actually convince ourselves that we could do it with some real data. Okay. So what are the implications of this? So I thought about the implications of this after listening to a whole bunch of other talks, and one question that maybe one could ask is, should we, instead of worrying about absolute things, is there some way to, let's say, rank entities in the financial system and start to get worried if their rank changes? Okay. So maybe I'll assume that the actual financial institutions, the banking system, that they know, you know, they'll get themselves out of whatever mess they may have gotten themselves into by hook or by crook, let's say, but if there's a major change in the ranking, then that means that maybe something just went seriously wrong with one institution and I should really pay attention to that, right? Liabilities can be of different classes. That's not a big thing. There's no stochastics. There's no time in here. I haven't, you could actually, so we were taking adjoints here. You can weight the adjoints in a slightly cleverer way. Now, what's sort of, I mentioned at the beginning, global squared. Okay, so there's two places where globality occurs here. First of all, the Eisenberg No thing. That's a whole network thing. Okay. Then the second thing is this projection that we took. Okay, a projection is a global thing. Okay, so I'm, you know, a matrix, you project it, and you have to, you know, take an inverse somewhere or other. So there, that's another place where there's something global. So these calculations can be very far reaching, right? It's not nearest neighbor. It's how this entity can affect that entity way far away through the chain of trades. Okay, just for the fun of it, I decided to write the statement algebraic geometry of systemic risk because I don't think I've ever seen those words together before. Okay, so I'm not sure that I have the whole, I don't think that we have the whole picture here, but it's sort of interesting that we could construct something which allows to start to see some geometry in the system which can be done with real data. Okay, I mean, this was real data. There's nothing random, no calibration of a model here. And where you can also, I mean, take the whole Eisenberg No thing and get out some, maybe something actionable in terms of a ranking. So that's about it. Thank you for your time.
Terry. Well, can we go back to the numbers and just the okay, you said that they weren't to be taken too literally, but this one that you finished with, which had the black and red numbers, how are these to be interpreted?
So the red ones. So, all right, the red ones are the ones which, if you do Eisenberg No, it is a default. That they're defaulting to other countries. Yeah.
And the ranking is what?
The ranking is that the UK is best. I think that's Austria's down there. That's no. What's worse? BEI. Let's see. Oh, Finland. So some of these things don't quite make Luxembourg. I don't quite believe that.
Is that best or worst?
So zero is probably going to be the worst. So I don't quite believe it. I hope no one's going to throw a stone at me from Luxembourg or something. But so there's so many things that don't quite make sense here. I mean the endowments. That's probably a source of a lot of. No, these were really sort of questionable. But okay, the point is you can start to talk about this and say, do I believe this, do I not, have a discussion.
I wanted to ask about, I guess, leverage and resolution.
Okay.
Because it's not actually true that you can net it out while everybody's talking and before they get turned red. But as soon as it turns red,
yeah.
In fact what happens, of course, is all the money goes to the lawyers. And it's no longer divergent free.
Yep, that's true. True.
Is it possible to actually take that into account? What's it do to the geometry of the situation?
I don't know. I suppose one would hope that would be a small.
Would you? I wouldn't at all. I would have thought that netting is exactly what breaks down. I mean, you think about Lehman Brothers or other things, once things start to go topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
That's what makes leverage dangerous.
Okay, yeah. Okay. All right, so by the point of leverage, though, is that this also, one of the nice things about the Eisenberg No is that it does, you can start to think about leverage, right? The endowments compared to the size of liabilities. Okay, I'll agree that once you actually clear the network, then all hell breaks loose. But theoretically, if you,
And I had another question, which is a more mathematical one.
Yeah.
And it's whether persistent homology has a role to play here, right? Because in a sense,
that's where this started from. We actually started thinking about persistent homology and constructing some barcodes So what we were thinking about doing originally was we were thinking about dialing up and down the endowments and using that to create a complex, right? And then doing some barcodes on that. Those were sort of cool. We were actually wondering about if we could coarse grain barcodes and control the network. Yeah.
Thomas.
Yeah. I'm a bit slow. In which way were you dissatisfied with Eisenberg No, and what did you add apart from a bit of algebra or topology?
I'm very humble in what I added, just sort of combining things together.
Can this formalism achieve anything which could not be achieved before?
Okay, so I guess the big picture is to combine Eisenberg No with a ranking system, okay? So I guess the question is, you take Eisenberg No and then you have a whole bunch of defaults. We're adding some rankings on top of that, yeah.
Yeah. Question on the far left.
Are these rankings in any way consistent with the rating of these countries, or
don't know yet. We're just sort of finishing this. This is our first.
But what is, like, in one sense, like, to take away from these rankings, like any like kind of like patterns you already.
We'd like to get some data that we trust better than what we have here. So that's
data that you use for the input.
What's that?
What kind of data are these?
This is data that's several years old. I think it was 2011, and it was from the BIS, and then, but we had to really sort of take wild flying leaps at the endowments. Okay. So that's one of the reasons why I'm really sort of.
The matrix was more credible, was it?
The matrix was more credible, yeah.
Have you tried doing this, like, with CDS data, for example?
Nope, not yet. Nope.
Yeah.
So the BIS data is usually interbank exposure statistics.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I would take a shot at the endowments with regard to capital of the respective banks in the banking system.
Yep.
And maybe that will help clarify the picture.
Yeah.
Question, you want a ranking. So ideally, the idea is that I select the first five banks because they are more, let's say, dangerous, riskiness. How would you handle a tie in your ranking?
I have no idea. I suppose that there's something to be said for randomness here. I don't know. I don't know what you would actually do. I don't know the best way to actually make a decision based upon this. What I could think of, though, would be that you have this ranking, and it's a numerical ranking. If they start to cross, okay, then maybe you should get worried, all right? If everyone is going up and down in the same way, then maybe there you have something which is systemic but parallel transport, okay? Maybe if everything is moving up and down in lockstep, maybe all the participants can figure out for themselves how to best, you know.
Geometrically, if you have two nodes that have exactly the same ranking, what does it mean in your geometry? Do we get
it just means that the math came out to be exactly the same.
We don't know why.
I don't know. It could be for a whole host of reasons. So it's a combination of the number of nodes and the size of the defaults, right? So if it ends, and that's all in a nonlinear way, but if it just ends up that they're the same, okay.
I may be a bit slow, but is there some simple way to understand what feature of the countries are ranked? I mean, is there centrality in the network?
No, it's not centrality. No.
Take off their defaults on other countries.
So that's the point. So one, if you have a loop which contains 10 counterparties, right? This sees it, right? Other thing that's, you know, you don't see it in other things, right? I mean, you could envision that you have a loop of 10 counterparties, and maybe the liabilities are in multiple classes, you know, foreign exchange, you know, CDO, right? You have complicated loops with multiple asset classes, whatever, but the liabilities are there, okay? So
what you're saying, so for example, if I take the defaulters and I take the country which is the biggest defaulter, so I don't remember if it's one or zero, but, so it means that you're not ranking just the immediate impact of the
default,
but also all the feedback.
That's all of the feedback, that's right.
So really the whole thing. Okay.
What would your ranking do if it was a tree? I know it's not in general. What would your ranking actually do? Because I'm not sure it should rank them. I think it should be a partial order.
Well, okay, so you would, if everything is symmetric, you know, if you have a whole bunch of symmetries, a bunch of them are probably going to be ranked the same. We haven't done that.
But what if it's actually the opposite, where there's a clear natural tree ordering, not a total ordering?
Which is
natural, that A depends on B and so on. I mean, would it then end up with a tree? Surely it shouldn't end up
No. So what you're trying to do is you're projecting onto the range of the one of the operators, right? So the projection is unique. So it's the philosophically it's the best projection, or it's the best ranking amongst all of them, which best matches up with the data. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So, right.
It's not capable of acknowledging that it's actually got its components.
That's right. It's just pure geometry. It's a more Penrose inverse type thing.
So it would rank a bank in Portugal against a bank in the US.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I still didn't get, what's that number supposed to be? AT is 0.6570.
Okay, so
that 0.6570.
It's an abstract number, okay, but it is basically the best ranking system, or the best ordering of the countries which respects the default weights in the system where you take into account loops, right? So at some level, if you have a loop of 10 counterparties and they're all at the same, they all are defaulting to each other at the same rate, right? What do you do, right? They should somehow be, I mean, back here in the initial thing. If you have a loop of defaults and all of them are $10, right? What does it mean? So somehow they should all be of similar rank then, right? But it's not the number of nodes. It's not the it's not any of the standard things. But they should all be ranked somehow the same if they're all defaulting to each other 10.
But so the number in the table, would that be the final money a country is left
no.
with or so?
No, it's the best rank which respects the loops and the defaults, you know, and the size of the defaults and the number of defaults. Okay? So it is a little, alright, so maybe to step back, we're not sure about the best way to explain it to an audience like this. That's I guess, the way that I'll gracefully exit.
But if I understand it correctly, then the number represents the systemic impact of that one.
Yes, it's the systemic impact, but that's maybe the best way to say it.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
But I can't parse it better than that.
I think it could be associated with the weights are kind of the effects from one node to the other, and those. You are basically doing some kind of netting of the.
That's right. Yeah.
Weights. So you're kind of using the geometry to.
That's right.
To do the netting, right? And the yes. effect of that yes. is you have a ranking on there.
Yes. Yes. That's right.
Okay. Well, let's close there and thank Richard again for the talk.
Thank you.